Tensions between the Trump administration and Iran are continuing to escalate.
Iranian proxy forces in Iraq have thought that they could act with impunity, and that if they acted, we wouldn't take strikes against Iran proper. We've made clear 4 months to the Iranian regime that that wouldn't be the case.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 6th, a look at what's next for U.S.-Iran relations. Also on the show, as severe wildfires become more common globally, indigenous experts say that one preventative method involves setting some fires intentionally.
At the core of those tribal or indigenous philosophies, fire is medicine, and when you prescribe it in the correct way, it can enhance and maintain ecosystem service production.
Plus, the foster care system is being scrutinized across the country for placing children in troubling conditions.
What's being accused in a lot of these states where there's lawsuits in play are that you're warehousing kids.
We start in Iran. Let's get going. Tensions between the United States and Iran have continued to escalate over the weekend after the United States' assassination of Iran's top military leader, Major General Qasem Soleimani, who commanded Iran's Revolutionary Guard. In a series of tweets on Saturday, President Trump threatened further military action, particularly against 52 locations in Iran, including cultural sites, if Iran retaliated against the United States. And yet, despite those threats, Ismail Kani, Soleimani's replacement, vowed revenge against the U.S. in response to Soleimani's killing. Iran also announced it would abandon key components of the landmark 2015 nuclear deal, almost 2 years after the U.S. withdrew from the deal. Thousands of Iranians have taken to the streets of Tehran to mourn the slain military leader. And Soleimani's killing has also increased U.S. tensions with Iraq, where Parliament voted in support of removing U.S. troops from their country. For more on this, we're joined by Robin Wright, a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and columnist at The New Yorker. Robin, great to have you back on the show.
Great to be with you, Tanzina.
So the airstrike that's killed Soleimani actually took place in Iraq. Let's start there. You spoke with Iraq's President Barham Saleh this weekend. What did he tell you about the fallout in Iraq following the killing of Soleimani?
The Iraqis are deeply concerned because they're still at war with ISIS. There are between 14,000 and 18,000 ISIS fighters still along Iraq's border with Syria. They're concerned about mopping up that operation before and worried about that there will be some kind of new conflict that plays out on its territory between Iran and the United States. Remember, Iraq has been at war now for 40 years, 23 years under Saddam Hussein and 17 years since the U.S. intervention in 2003. And it's feeling very fragile because recent protests have forced the prime minister to resign. He's only in a caretaker position. And the country desperately needs foreign investment and assistance to stabilize so that the young are employed rather than lured into more extremist groups. So there's the stakes in the aftermath of Soleimani's assassination are huge, not just for Iran and the United States, but for the entire Middle East. And Iraq is now at the epicenter of all this and deeply concerned that it will become the battlefield, the theater, the arena of some kind of overt or covert campaign.
What could that mean, Robin, for the fight against ISIS going forward? I mean, we know that the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq and Syria, as you mentioned, Syria, said it would suspend operations against the Islamic State.
It's huge, Tanzina, because the United States had been on the offensive. It had played an incredible role in mobilizing an international coalition. Many other countries are still in Iraq, too, and they also face being expelled because the Iraqi parliament called for the removal of all foreign forces. But in the aftermath of the assassination, the coalition led by the United States and some 5,000 American troops have said they are going to suspend operations and basically become a defensive operation just to protect themselves, not dealing with the aftermath of the ISIS caliphate, not engaging in operations to stabilize the fragile Iraqi government.
We heard Secretary of State Mike Pompeo brush aside the calls of the Iraqi parliament to end the presence of American troops in that country. Does Iraq have any leverage over the United States here?
Well, I think the government is caught kind of between Iran and the United States. Clearly, the United States does not want ISIS to reemerge. In that sense, Iraq has a little bit of leverage, but, you know, President Trump has always talked about pulling all American troops out of the region, and in some ways this accomplishes one of his goals. The problem is that the military challenge remains, and we saw that in the aftermath of the Obama administration's decision to withdraw in 2011 and how that led to the rise or created the open space for the emergence of ISIS, which swept through with lightning speed and seized a third of Syria and a third of Iraq, creating a whole new country, effectively, at least for 4 years, and changing the borders of the modern Middle East. The stakes here are huge.
And over the weekend, as the narrative was emerging about why the president chose to make this move on Soleimani, the Trump administration and the president said Soleimani was planning attacks on American lives. We heard Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on some of the Sunday shows say that it was a series of events, not one particular event, that prompted this. How much intelligence evidence do we have to support what either of these folks is saying?
There's been nothing said publicly, and those who are supposed to be briefed within the House and the Senate have not yet received full briefings. They're hoping to get it this week. The question of what the threat was comes in the aftermath of questions about what justified the U.S. intervention in Iraq in the first place in 2003, when the United States claimed that there were weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. And as we found out, there weren't any. There's a deep concern about the level of intelligence, the specificity. The Iraqis actually said that Soleimani was scheduled to see government officials the next morning on a diplomatic mission. Now, how you define diplomatic would probably differ between the United States, Iraq, and Iran. But I think there are going to be some deep concerns because we do know that there were some in the Pentagon who were flabbergasted, to put it mildly, when the president chose the most radical option among those made available to him, and that was to assassinate Soleimani. A bad guy for sure, but the question is, what was he intending to do, and what is U.S. strategy in the aftermath? Are we just winging it as all of these things play out, or is there an off-ramp, an exit strategy, a game plan, just a basic game plan about what to do?
Well, what we do know is that President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama declined to target Soleimani. And given that the intelligence so far seems thin, at least as far as the public knows, I'm wondering, given domestic and international laws, was this attack legal? Are we considering whether or not the president has once again crossed the line here?
Well, this is a divisive issue in Washington, and I think it's going to play out in the weeks to come. The administration says that the president had the right to take military action to defend American lives and American interests. But it also appears that the kind of legal basis for this is being tied to the original authorization for the use of military force, what's called an AUMF, that was given by Congress in 2001 after the attack on 9/11 that allowed the U.S. to act in Afghanistan. We have used that, extended that mandate to include deployments in Iraq and Syria and to prolong our physical presence militarily in the region. So there are good questions that will be asked, and I think there are those among Democrats who will probably try to move to limit the authorization to take military action in Iran, partly to avoid an all-out war.
So, Robin, Iran did announce that it would end its commitments to several key aspects of the 2015 nuclear deal. But given that the U.S. pulled out of that same deal in 2018, how significant is that?
It's very important. This story got way out of was exaggerated very quickly. People don't understand enough about how you make a bomb and what was agreed to in the nuclear deal. What happened was, as you rightly pointed out, President Trump withdrew from the deal in 2018 and 6 months later reimposed sanctions. Iran stuck to the deal for a year, as did the five other parties to the deal, Britain, France, China, Russia, and Germany. But as the economic benefits were not felt by Iran, they began slowly to breach its commitments. These are all reversible steps. It began in mid-2019, a year after Trump withdrew, breaching, taking steps that it thought would help pressure the administration into either going back to the original nuclear deal or dealing with Iran on terms that were not kind of one-sided. The latest step is a fifth breach, but Iran is still complying with inspections. So all of the UN, the International Atomic Energy Agency monitors who are in Iran, all the equipment that monitors all their military sites is still in place. It's an ominous development, absolutely, but it's not a fatal development yet.
So to that point, Robin, I'm thank you for the clarification there. And to that point, there are lots of concerns about the 2003 invasion of Iraq and lots of parallels that are being drawn here. I'm curious, you said that this story, particularly about the Iranian relationship with the 2015 nuclear deal, has been overblown. Are you seeing the media sort of handling this in a way that's at least accurate or sensitive or nuanced? Or is it starting to go down certain paths that it shouldn't and that are reminiscent of the way the media covered 2003?
Well, I think particularly on this issue of what did Iran do on the nuclear program, it's easy to overstate it when it said it's no longer going to limit the number of centrifuges. That sends alarm bells off everywhere. But I've talked to arms control experts, people who are involved in, you know, lifelong programs to limit nuclear proliferation. And they say this is a worrisome development, but it is something that can be reversed. There is still, if miracle upon miracles, there's some kind of diplomatic outreach to try to get the two countries back to the negotiating table. This can be reversed. But Iran is clearly not going to be taking any of this lightly, whether it's withdrawal of the nuclear deal, the maximum pressure by the Trump administration, and most recently the Soleimani assassination. We're not talking about the Taliban in Afghanistan, a flaky militia that had a tenuous hold in Afghanistan. We're not talking about Saddam Hussein's Iraq, where the military was inept and willing to turn around and walk away. The Iranian Revolution, whatever you feel about it, has now been in place 40 years. Soleimani was incredibly important to its mission to get the U.S. to withdraw from the region. But Iran has a very deep bench, and it will take several actions, including actions on the nuclear program, action militarily, to retaliate and also to put pressure on the Trump administration, because it has its own broader agenda on diplomacy, too. So this is going to play out for a long time to come on a lot of different levels.
Robin Wright is a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and columnist at The New Yorker. Robin, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
My name is Pupak. I'm calling from Paramus, New Jersey. I just came back from Iran. A large part of my family still lives there. I feel anger and fear. I don't want my beautiful country to become another Syria, Afghanistan, or Iraq. I don't want to lose my family to an unjust war.
The day after Trump was elected, I told friends that he'd create a war in his final year in order to ensure that he was reelected, because we don't change presidents in the middle of a war very often. Rich Minton, Belmont, Mass.
Hi, my name's Beth from Pittsburgh. My husband is an Iranian-born U.S. citizen. We're traveling to Israel in 2 weeks, and now we don't know what to expect when we come back. Will we be allowed back home? We got married last year, and the travel ban prevented much of our family from coming to the wedding. It feels like living in the Twilight Zone.
This is Brandon from Garland. I just feel like almost anything Trump does at this point is a distraction from his impeachment. And the bigger the distraction, the better off his chances are for reelection.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
We are now in a position where we're saying to people, it is not safe to move. It is not safe to leave these areas.
It's too smoky. Can't do anything. It's not fun anymore. It's just scary waiting. So yeah, pretty keen to get out.
Suddenly embers were coming over, but hundreds of embers just fast, just flying through the air. The wind was howling. The fire just created its own wind. It was just horrific, unbelievable.
I just can't even imagine trying to rebuild this town. With all of these houses lost, it's going to be really hard.
We chose what we could save, houses that were defendable, and we just had to treat it as triage. Pick your battles and go in.
How come we already had four trucks to defend our town. Because our town doesn't have a lot of money, but we have hearts of gold, Mr. Prime Minister.
Every now and then I just feel nauseous at the thought of what's happened and at the recovery effort that's got to happen here.
The fires are not over. The crisis is not over. There are months to go. Particularly in the southern states.
I actually have held it together pretty well till yesterday when I heard that it could be coming back. And that's when I had my breakdown.
In Australia, wildfires continue to devastate the southern part of the country. So far, at least 20 people have died and roughly 2,000 homes have been destroyed. And ecologists say nearly 500 million animals have been killed since the fires started in September. As global warming causes temperatures to rise, hotter and drier conditions are playing a significant role in the growing intensity of wildfires across the world. One solution, supported by Indigenous communities in both Australia and here in the United States, involves setting fires intentionally.
At the core of those tribal or Indigenous philosophies, fire is medicine, and when you prescribe it in the correct way, it can enhance and maintain ecosystem service production.
That is
Frank Lake, a Forest Service research ecologist with the Pacific Southwest Research Station Fire and Fuels Program. I'm also a Karuk descendant, having grown up with my Yurok and Karuk family in northwestern California.
Frank works at the United States Forest Service, and one of his main priorities is to incorporate tribal knowledge into the federal government's fire management strategies.
Society and many land managers or fire managers are struggling with how to learn to live with wildfire. And most of the assumptions are that these are natural areas or that there was a wilderness or that there was a very little effect of Aboriginal or Indigenous people, particularly their fire use and stewardship in these systems. Yet there's these long-term, deep relationships of Aboriginal or Indigenous people with fire that affected the fire regimes and affected fire effects across the landscape, across many different ecosystems and habitats.
Today, scientists in the United States Forest Service largely agree with tribal members that intentionally burning sections of forest is an important way to protect against wildfires. But many tribal experts say we need to dramatically step up our use of prescribed fires going forward. Joining me now is Chukchuk Hillman, a Kuruk Indian who works with the Kuruk Tribe's Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for coming on the show, Chukchuk.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. And I'm excited to talk to you about this because our guest at the top said that fire is medicine. And if you can explain how it works, I mean, what does a prescribed fire look like exactly?
Well, nowadays it looks quite a bit different from historical use just because the landscape has been lacking fire, you know, since contact. And really, you know, we're a late contact community here. Contact didn't happen until about 1851, and the miners really didn't like fire, and then landscape kind of built up with, lots of material, flammable material that it's in a bad way now. So now we have to have lots of resources available to do prescribed fire, where traditionally you could have just a couple family members burn off large sections of landscape, and so it's not like you don't do it to just be prepared for wildfire. You're working with fire for health on the landscape and these fire-dependent plant communities and human communities.
So how is it that, I mean, because it sounds counterintuitive to say that burning parts of the forest is the best way to fight wildfires. How does it work exactly?
So for one, you've got a chunk of black, you know, but what we're looking for, we're not looking for just gray, completely charred ground. You're looking for some black that still has some carbon in it, you know, so you're looking for a low to moderate intensity fire. And so then once some wildfire comes through, it's not going to burn that area so hot because you don't have the fuel load up. So even if it's at a bad time of year, if it's not, the fire's not getting up into the crowns of the trees, you can have a low to moderate intensity understory fire. Like I said, right now, there's so many fir trees because they call plantations over here that are, you know, like cornfields, but for dug fir for timber production. And so those places are really unnatural landscape features that are now really dangerous when you have fire. But traditionally we had a much more open landscape in the lower elevation areas where humans are living, and you're using fire all the time, but in different intervals for different plant species, sometimes in the spring, sometimes in the fall, sometimes even in the summer when the conditions are appropriate for those plant communities. You already have ridges as natural holding features that are more open and can just take fire in a healthy way. And that's what we're trying to do, is set the landscape on a trajectory to accept fire in a good way. Because, yeah, you can burn off pretty good chunks of land, just a couple people, if the landscape is ready to take it and you don't have a huge fuel loading, the landscape can take it in a healthy way.
Has the federal government worked with your tribe to carry out these burns? And if so, what does that look like?
Well, that's just now starting. It's taken a really long time, and that's something that we have in common with Aboriginal folks in Australia, too. We had a person from the government and an Aborigine man come up here and visit me last year, and they saw the writing on the wall, and they were attempting to move in the same direction, working as partners to get fire on the land. So we have the federal government working with us. There's still a lot of work to be done, but we're hoping that we can be in time to save some of these forested areas and valued resources in these communities.
Chuchuk, you mentioned that you had a visit from an Aboriginal tribe member in Australia. Tell me what they were looking for, given that they are going through their own natural disaster right now.
Well, that's what he was coming up to meet with me about, is how to avert a natural disaster like this, you know. And part of it, I would say it's an unnatural disaster because of, you know, this criminalizing indigenous fire. You've taken out humans from the ecosystem, which, you know, I would posit humans are a naturally occurring element in nature. And so if you take humans out of the equation and our use of fire, then you have an unnatural situation where then when some lightning strikes or something, you have this, you know, incredible disaster. But that's what is missing from our oral history. If we have all these stories going back thousands and thousands of years, and what's not in those stories is catastrophic wildfire. But it's because of our relationship with fire. And that's what humans have to reconcile, is a relationship with fire. And I'd like to make the point that just the way that it's talked about here in the U.S. and other places, when a human has, you know, some relationship to fire, they're called a pyromaniac. Like, we talk about it like it's a mental health issue, when really it's not. It's our responsibility to the world is to use fire to keep the world healthy.
There's been an interesting history, particularly when it comes to prescribed fires here in the United States. We know that since the 1960s, the National Park Service has allowed for some of these prescribed fires to take place. But prior to that, there was a history of criminalizing fire, these prescribed fires. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that, particularly how white settlers responded to tribal fire practices in the 1800s and 1900s.
Yeah, well, you colonize and then you criminalize. And, you know, this is our birthright, you know, it's a responsibility. We say that when you're born with hands and thumbs, you have this responsibility to the world. And fire is one of those things that we have some power to work with. And you take it out and it's going to be an issue. And the Weeks Act was passed in 1911. And so that was when fire suppression really got kicking pretty strong over in our area here. But yeah, it's you could be hung, shot, imprisoned for doing that. And I mean, we have documentation from a forest ranger here in our area saying the only way to stop Indians from burning is to take a shot. He said they're like coyotes in the bushes, always lighting fires. But we weren't lighting fires for no reason.
I'm wondering also if you could tell, we got about a minute left in the segment, you could tell us what policies you want to see the U.S. government put in place for prescribed fires.
Well, just working with local indigenous communities, wherever you are, go to the local indigenous people, because they've been doing this for a really, really long time. You got to work with your local community, and I'm not sure what that looks like in each community.
Chuchuk Hillman is a Kuruk Indian who works with the Kuruk Tribe's Department of Natural Resources. Chuchuk, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Over the past few years, the foster care system in the state of Oregon has been in crisis. When the state is unable to place foster care children in stable housing, it sometimes houses children in hotels, motels, and even offices.
The offices where the kids were being housed in some cases were actually the offices where the caseworkers are trying to do their work. And then that would mean a caseworker or a couple of caseworkers would need to stay overnight, earning overtime, and being away from their families to care for these children.
That is
Hillary Borud. I'm the state politics and government reporter for the Oregonian newspaper in Portland, Oregon.
So Hillary told us that when advocates sued Oregon to end this practice, the state began using an approach that was at times even more drastic.
They turned increasingly to institutional or congregate care, basically group homes or larger facilities for these children they had a hard time housing. And in some cases, those were even state juvenile jails that had been converted into treatment centers.
Congregate care is supposed to mean a supervised group home or institutional setting. But in Oregon, hundreds of children were sent to these juvenile centers. And in some cases, they faced prison-like conditions.
You can't avoid the fact that these were built or designed as jails. The kids are staying in rooms that look kind of like cells. And then one of these facilities, in subsequent reporting, I found out this particular facility was basically conditioning access to tampons for girls on good behavior. They had access to sanitary pads, but if they wanted to earn tampons, they needed to rack up some good behavior points.
Oregon isn't the only state where kids in foster care face these conditions. West Virginia has also used juvenile detention centers. And both states have faced lawsuits over the treatment of children in their care. The federal government attempted to address this problem back in 2018 when Congress passed the Family First Prevention Services Act. And it went into effect this past October, and it's meant to dramatically change the way congregate care is used across the country.
So before Family First took effect, there was no limit to the length of time that a child could stay in a congregate care placement with federal money continuing to flow. Now, under the Family First Act, the limit is 2 weeks.
That's John Kelly, editor-in-chief at the Chronicle of Social Change.
So as a result, states and local governments are really going to have to think through whether they intend to take more of the financial responsibility of paying for congregate care on or think through new options for the children that they have been putting into those homes.
I spoke to John about why so many children have ended up in congregate care over the years and the effect it's had on their lives.
Generally, congregate care consists of largely older youths in foster care, as well as youths with very acute behavioral needs. And the sort of criticism of congregate care use is that it is often a placement of last resort as opposed to a placement of need, so that these kids are ending up there not because people feel that congregate care is the best option for them, as much as the systems are having a hard time finding a foster home or a relative placement that people generally agree are more suitable.
So do the reasons that children end up in this type of care range from state to state, or is it pretty much the same across the board?
There are certainly states that use congregate care more often than others for very young children. I believe South Carolina, as part of their settlement in a class action lawsuit over child welfare services, is one that has committed to try and lower its use of congregate care for very young children. So the use of congregate care for older kids and for kids with high needs, that is a pretty nationwide pattern. Now, the use of congregate care in terms of quantity, we have kind of crunched the federal numbers and found that, you know, interestingly, while the number of kids in foster care in total in the country has gone up in recent years, basically from 2012 up until about 2017, the number of kids in congregate care has actually declined. But that is not an airtight story across the country. There's 20 states that between 2011 and 2017 saw an increase in the number of kids who were in congregate care. And of those 20 states, 10 of them saw an increase of 20% or more. New Hampshire really stood out as the one that basically almost tripled during that time.
So across the board, John, you said we're seeing a decrease nationwide, but then there are certain states that are seeing an uptick. What's leading to that uptick in those states?
One likely factor is that as they've seen the number of kids in foster care in general rise, they have been challenged to find foster homes or appropriate relative options for some of those children, and that they are resorting to congregate care, especially for the older youth coming into foster care.
Does this have anything to do with the opioid crisis that we've been hearing about for the past couple of years? Does it have anything to do with income inequality that we see exacerbated in this country today?
The federal government, in putting out their annual data on foster care, has kind of closely tied the increase in recent years with a growing number of cases where substance abuse by the parent is kind of an indicated reason for removal. I certainly think there is some connection to the opioid crisis. I don't think it's just a complete tight-fitting narrative that that's the case in all states. We have spoken to officials in other states, in some states where, you know, meth is still the big driver, in their opinion, of substance abuse-related cases where kids come into care.
Let's talk a little bit about what these facilities are like. What are the conditions for children who are housed there? We mentioned there are hotels, juvenile detention centers. What do these places look like generally?
You know, the traditional options that are kind of quantified as congregate care are group homes. And these are generally buildings where there'll be multiple bedrooms to house somewhere around, you know, 7 to 12 children, generally, again, of older age. And they'll be surrounded with youth workers or counselors and social workers who are staffing that place. The other option within congregate care is called institutions, and that ranges pretty widely from residential facilities all the way to a more secure psychiatric facility.
A lot of these children, we said, are experiencing mental health challenges in addition to just being caught up in the system, in the foster care system, which in itself can be traumatic. When these children end up in these congregate care units, what types of services should they expect or should they be getting?
Well, what any foster youth should be getting is a meaningful connection to permanent adults that are in their life. They should be getting any sort of mental health needs and health needs filled, and they should be getting a stable attempt at education. Now, I don't think that that's the case in every state and in every situation when it comes to congregate care. And I think that Congress really heard that when they held hearings in the past decade, you know, from youth who had experienced their placement in congregate care. And they heard from youth who really felt like they were treated somewhat like inmates in group homes. And again, that's not the case in all of them. But I think that there are a lot of youth who feel that the normalcy of being a teen or being an adolescent is really hard when you're living in a house where maybe the cabinets are locked at night, or the fridge is locked at night, and your movements within the house are controlled.
What are the long-term effects on children who are in congregate care facilities in terms of their access to education? You mentioned that might be lacking in terms of their long-term mental health.
Well, I would say that this is an area that is ripe for research exploration because there's very little in the way of robust research on outcomes, actual outcomes associated with time in congregate care. We know there was I think it was in 2014, you know, a very large meta-analysis, a review of all the research that found that, you know, when you're looking at youth's perception of care and their internal and external behaviors, that youth who were placed with family homes, family foster homes, fared better. There was a small study in California in 2014 that found that youth who were placed in congregate care were more likely to drop out and less likely to graduate. They tested below in some subjects youth who were placed with foster families. And then I think a 2008 study that found that youth who had spent time in congregate care were about 2.5 times more likely to be arrested. And that was in a large undisclosed urban county. You know, when Congress went to limit federal funding for congregate care, the hearings and what they got out of that was more emotional and moral than it was based on research.
Is there anything positive we can say about congregate care?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that there are certainly congregate care providers in this country who do a very good job and are able to demonstrate results. Congregate care should be a brief intervention in a child's life. We should not hope for any child to be in a group home or an institution for a long time. It should be an option that we use either to manage crisis or because the system is in crisis and is just in a shortage of homes, but it should not be something for a long time. And I think there are a lot of providers in that community, you know, Children's Village comes to mind in New York, who really believe that to be their role. We want these children to be back in their community, either with their parents or with another family, quickly.
There are children in some cases who run away from these institutions, which is, I don't think it's surprising, but are you seeing an increase in that? And if so, what happens to those kids?
We haven't seen any national trend on increase in runaways that I'm aware of. What I can tell you, though, for sure, is that it becomes a huge intermixing of child welfare and juvenile justice in a lot of places, because in an attempt to locate these children, sometimes it's technically a status offense, you know, to run away if a court has ordered you not to. So we have seen that come up in New York City recently, as well as in other systems, where the act of actually running away can become criminalized or kind of count against the kid that in that way.
Do these kids understand that? I mean, it feels like these are children who are dealing with a lot already. And in addition to the burden of mental health issues, are they even aware? Do they have appropriate representation when a court is telling them whether or not this is an offense?
That's a great question. I'm quite certain that youth are not up on like all of the different truancy and status offense laws, but I think that they are afforded an attorney if their case actually ends up in a juvenile court. Whether or not, when they make a decision to run away from placement, any of that's in their mind, I'm sure that's a case-by-case basis of based on what kids are cognizant of. But, you know, I think it's fair to say that if they're making the decision to run away from a placement, they've already decided that this isn't somewhere they want to be.
Who's paying for this?
Generally, foster care is paid for to some extent in a cost split between state and local governments and the federal government. There is an entitlement, a federal entitlement called Title 4E, through which states receive sort of a matched amount of money for youth whose parents basically meet an income test. And so billions come out of the federal government every year to help states pay for foster care placements and for adoption subsidies as well. But I would say the lion's share of the money is state and local taxpayer dollars. Generally, congregate care is provided by either nonprofits or private providers who contract with those states and local governments.
There are a number of lawsuits, John, that have been filed against states for housing children in places like temporary shelters and out-of-state for-profit facilities. There's been one lawsuit most recently in West Virginia. Where do these lawsuits stand, and what's the end goal here? Is it to shut down these facilities?
I think it's not to shut them down as much as it is to force systems to use congregate care for a very limited set of purposes, and not, you know, essentially what's being accused in a lot of these states where there's lawsuits in play are that you're warehousing kids. You know, you don't have enough foster parents to handle the number of kids that you are removing from parents, and that you are resorting to these congregate care options, not necessarily because it's the best thing for a child, but because it's what all you have to offer. And so I think that that's the goal a lot of times with the class action lawsuits, which do vary from state to state in terms of what the relief is that they seek.
Back in December, we actually spoke with Judge Ernestine Gray in New Orleans, who has drastically lowered the number of children in foster care just across the board in her jurisdiction. But when we talk about doing that, John, does that mean that these children are being placed with families? Does it mean that something else is happening?
Well, Judge Gray definitely has made headlines as a longtime veteran knowledgeable judge who has stepped up and really forced systems to make a strong case for even taking the child into foster care. You know, we've been talking about what do you do after they have been removed? Where do they go then? But really, the easiest way to lower the number of kids in any foster care placement is to just not take them into foster care in the first place. And, you know, the other side of the coin when it came to the Family First Act was trying to provide more federal resources to help states do just that. The other part of Family First is that for the first time, you can use that federal entitlement we talked about, Title 4E, to provide services to families that are aimed at preventing the use of foster care in certain child welfare cases. So the situation has been deemed serious enough that there needs to be intervention, but with you know, services provided and it paid for in part by the federal government, they would be able to keep the family unit together while they worked through it. And that can look either like an actual parent stays with the child through, you know, whether it's substance abuse treatment or a mental health intervention or in-home parenting classes and assistance, or it can mean the use of, you know, relying on relatives to maybe temporarily care for a child outside the foster care realm, but sort of like temporarily while services are being administered to a parent.
John Kelly is the editor-in-chief at the Chronicle of Social Change. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.